Alright, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts Matt and Tim.
And welcome to the either awesomely sounding Sound of Matt edition of SLS Cast or the Oh Dear God, What Happened to His Voice edition of the SLS Cast. Thankfully, no matter what decision you choose, we have two wonderful people who can talk more than me.
Why, thank you, Matt. We're just going to try to make everything you say completely, like there's going to be a giant contrast between our voices and your voices.
Yes, you guys are just going to
make it super awkward.
Yes, I mean, it's going to be better than Frau Blücher asking, you know, some awful teen, perhaps. No, thank you. Good night. So, how's everybody doing? Oh, by the way, guys, Mikey is on his little Portland sojourn, and so in his stead, we have a visitor, hopefully not a one-time visitor. It's our new person, Andy. Andy,
hello.
Why don't you say hello again?
Hello.
Yes, there we go.
I'm saying hello again.
Yes, even. And, you know, tell us a little about yourself, sir.
California native from the Bay Area, went to USC Film School, have done very little with that degree as I still work there, but I get to see a lot of movies for free, sometimes early, and yeah.
Outstanding, very cool. And then of course Tim is with us.
Yes, I am.
That's not a very good contrast.
No, it really wasn't. I was trying too hard, I think.
Yes. So, well, what's been going on in your world? How was the remainder of your Houston visit, sir?
It was a lot of fun. I was constantly moving around and visiting people, family and friends. Was in a wedding last weekend, and it was the most Texified wedding I've ever been in. I mean, the reception was in a barn, for heaven's sakes, and the entire wedding was on a plantation. And believe it or not, there was only one black guy at the wedding. I should just throw that out there. Only one. So it was a very segregated kind of feeling of a wedding. But it was beautiful, nonetheless. Very nice.
Was there line dancing or a hoedown?
You know, not as much as there should be. I mean, every slow song was kind of like a country song. I'm not like the very twangy country, but somewhat of what people would call, I guess, the prettier country songs, I guess. But then the most, like, they do like the Cupid Shuffle, and that one song where the lyrics are something kind of like "All the girls with the titties come here." So, I mean, I don't know. I don't listen to it.
Alrighty, but. Yeah, that's
a thing that exists.
Yeah, it does now. If it didn't before, so you know, I'm just surprised they didn't do Gorillaz.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So. Andrew, have you heard that song before? The Gorilla song by
Bruno Mars.
Bruno Mars.
No.
You should treat yourself to that. That would be.
I assumed you were talking about a song by Gorillaz, which would be much better.
Oh, I agree.
Yes.
I mean, I put something on Facebook, just saying how like every little bit of respect that I had for Bruno Mars went down the toilet because of the song, and somebody commented on it saying that, "What are you talking about?" And I said like the song doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, yes, it does make sense. He's just talking about that he's like a gorilla, like he's acting like a gorilla. And it's like, well, you know, you can talk about a song and call yourself, or you know, like kind of allude to the fact that you're being like a gorilla, but you don't have to go all out and say that you are a gorilla every like five lines.
Does he make animal noises?
Not exactly. One step away, though. I think, you know, it's all about having sex like gorillas, but. Yeah, so that's cool. You know, that's good. You know, get a little bit of gorilla action going on to replace our 50 Shades of Grey action that we, you know, can't always have, I suppose. But, you know, for my wedding was pretty similar to the one that you described, sir. I had the actual Texas flag bow tie and vest combo for my tux, and you know, we had all the cool Texas colors. We actually had barbecue for the reception and everything, and lots of beer, and it was in a dance hall. So, yeah.
Lone Star and Shiner?
No. At the time, we could only get, because we weren't paying for it, so we had to get whatever was being given to us, which was a keg of Bud Light. So we may do, though. We may do.
Yeah.
As one does.
We floated that keg. It was not a problem.
Were you doing keg stands at your wedding?
No, even I wasn't, you know, that off.
I would love to get a picture of you doing a keg stand wearing your, you know, your American flag bow tie and matching vest.
No, it was a Texas flag.
Oh, it was a Texas flag?
Yes, it was Texas flag, not an American flag.
It wasn't the Confederate flag, was it?
Let's not be tacky. It was a Texas flag. Yeah, see, look, y'all got that. See, that was cool. All right, so everybody's doing well then. I'm sick, but other than that, doing okay on spring break myself. So getting ever closer to my Disney trip, very excited about that. And
Southern California or Florida?
For me, there is no other place than Walt Disney World.
I see.
I understand that there is some reasonable facsimile that was an original concept in California, but it was done correctly in Florida, and you know, I'm just hating. Actually, there's nothing wrong with Disneyland.
No, it's a typical, like, Midwest. It depends on which side you're closer to. I feel like that if you're from California, you scoff at Disney World, and if you're from Florida, you scoff at Disneyland, and then if you're in the middle, you pick one.
Yeah, and me, I grew up all over the United States. I lived in California as a child, but I also lived primarily in Florida. So I went to Disney World my whole life, so that's all. You know, it's good stuff. This will be a first time for me to really... It's Jen and I just on our own, no kids, going away for a week, so we're really excited.
Nice.
Yeah. So at any rate, how about some news, guys? News. Who has news?
I'll start off this one. So the new Evil Dead movie is coming out.
Yes.
And already, I guess since Sam Raimi has been doing the press rounds with the Oz movie, somebody asked him about doing another Army of Darkness movie, and it turns out this summer he will be pinning Army of Darkness 4. I mean, excuse me, Evil Dead 4, but it's recently has been like retitled to Army of Darkness 2. And apparently it's going to be a direct sequel to Army of Darkness, so it will have Bruce Campbell as Ash. And I guess a lot of people were worried about it being a little bit conflicting with the new Evil Dead movie. And I kind of got this out of what Sam Raimi said, but it could be along the same lines as being kind of in a, like, within the same realm, but, like, in a, like, another, like, dimensional type of thing. So it's possibly, in the future, these characters could, you know, come in contact in some way, which is kind of interesting.
Kind of like Star Trek Generations.
Exactly, yeah, that's exactly how they were kind of comparing it to. Also, in other news, Jon Stewart is going to take an entire summer off from doing The Daily Show, and he's going to pursue his dream of directing an indie drama movie. I thought that was kind of interesting, and I just only hope they bring in Larry Sanders to replace him. Well, thank you for getting that one.
I'm sorry, I don't watch The Daily Show, so...
You didn't watch The Larry Sanders Show with Gary Shandling?
Oh, okay, I watched that show. All right.
Yeah, gotcha. You know, Jon Stewart comes in at the end, and he takes over, and... They kind of have a feud.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm sick.
It was a deep joke. It was a deep joke.
No, that's okay. I should have gotten that, but I'm not with it right now. You'll have to forgive me.
It's okay.
That took a lot of effort to put that together. Holy crap.
What kind of drugs are you on?
None. I should probably be on some. I'm pretty feverish, actually.
We should take a break, and you should chug an entire bottle of NyQuil, and then we should continue recording, and... I would like just to see or hear about all the things that you begin to, like, hallucinate. And my last bit of news... That's right, I only have 3 pieces of news this time. Could it be possible... And I'm throwing this out there as a question. Could it be possible that the visual effects artists that are protesting, if anybody can recall, during the Academy Awards, there were a group of visual effects artists outside of the Dolby Theater that were protesting... they were especially mad because Life of Pi's Ang Lee won for Best Director, and that's a very special effects heavy movie, as well as a special effects house that worked on Life of Pi has filed for bankruptcy. Now, could it be possible that these protesting visual effects artists could use cyber attacks against certain movie studios, like do things to purposefully ruin their movies?
I mean, I suppose, but that takes a different degree of computer skill. They're not necessarily just because you can do, just because you know how to use AutoCAD does not necessarily mean you know how to install a virus. You know
well,
I don't mean like a virus.
I mean like, instead of putting out a quality product, you just put out a, you know, an all right product.
Well, I think that would be the technological equivalent of cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, if even though I don't see where they have any kind of grievance, but they feel that they have a legitimate gripe. Okay, fine. The answer to their gripe is not to do subpar work, because all that does is, all that does at the end of the day is gives everybody else an out to say, well, look, they sucked, so they deserve to lose their job. And at the same time, they also hurt their own portfolio going forward, saying, well, their work was good, but look at the last four pictures they've been on. It's been crap. So then they won't get hired at all.
Yeah. Well, actually, according to CinemaBlend.com, and this is actually more about going along like a virus within the visual effects community, like through the computers and whatnot, working on a specific production. This is quoting CinemaBlend. Citing slim evidence that such a cyber attack would be waged, Variety goes on record to say that there are concerns within the visual effects community that an offensive could be launched that, quote, damaged or destroyed visual effects assets, end quote, and could, quote, set back production by months, cost each picture, affected tens of millions of dollars, and wreak havoc with release dates, end quote. In the long term, smaller effects houses that suddenly report a sabotage of visual effects work could lose the trust of the major studios that employ them, leading to even more financial woes down the line. Yeah, that's pretty... I mean, this big hoopla about all these people, and I remember talking to you about this, Matt, about the whole, you know, them protesting, and a lot of these visual effects houses are in this situation because of poor budgeting. And it just seems ridiculous that instead of figuring out a way to solve the problem and move on, a lot of people just keep bitching about it, and even, you know, kind of like what you just said, screwing themselves over to really be successful and grow in the future.
And even worse, them going this route, if they do follow through with this route, and it does potentially, and it does prove to go exactly as the article predicts, then what I would see happening in that instance is the studios would start developing their own in-house, either under the corporate banner, like Fox will come up with the, you know, like Fox would reabsorb, for instance, ILM. That's not going to happen. Clearly, Disney owns them. But, you know, so let's say Fox reabsorbs ILM, for instance, and now makes them an in-house visual effects studio. I mean, they're completely screwed, because now they have to do everything exactly how Fox says that they're going to do it, so on and so forth. I mean, that would be the worst case scenario. And I think that the studios would do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I'm not fully caught up on the whole protest. I know that I've been intrigued by it, and I don't have numbers, but I would say part of it is sort of what Matt just touched on is, yeah, so Disney owns ILM. They treat them as a separate entity in a way, but I would think that more studios would already have their own in-house things by now, much like they usually have all of their own cameras and grip equipment and stuff like that, as well as their own actual locations that they use, hence the studio. But I'm not entirely sure what the financial statistics are, but my basic understanding is that the independent visual effects houses get less than they may deserve in terms of the money, whereas you have the director will get, you know, above the line prices, but then literally without all those people, you have nothing left. It's not the same as like, hey, will you add a little flame to this thing that we shot? It's, we have nothing, you're gonna create it all, but you don't quite get paid you know, equitably for that.
True, but it is still a bid contract process. It's not like, you know, the studio goes to these visual effects houses and says, we'd like to hire you, and we're going to pay you $1 a day for your entire staff, and you have to produce the special effects for our $300 million project, and you have to do everything we say. And then the visual effects house goes, okay, sure. No, that's not how it happens. I mean, they submit bids, and I mean, it's a bidding process, and then they work and develop contracts. And if you are not savvy when you create a contract, you leave yourself open for, well, we didn't budget for them to change their mind. You should have budgeted for us to change your mind.
Yeah, I mean, the FX maybe just need a better, if they even have one, union for stuff like that. Because, of course, the whole idea of bidding for contracts and stuff, whoever can do it lowest and fastest, but at the same time, you then are going to pour a bunch of money into all kinds of other stuff, get a whole bunch of, hopefully, the goal would be to make a big profit on the movie, and then you're, most of what you profited from in the long term was sort of almost forgotten about by the time you start making money.
Yeah, and what gets me is that there are big visual effects houses getting paid a ton of money, and then you have these independent visual effects houses getting paid a substantial less amount. But then there are some cases where the bigger special effects department creates a really crummy-looking movie when you have a independent special effects house creating a really cool product. And so,
right.
Yeah, that's what gets me. And I kind of wonder if soon the idea of the whole one independent studio system from, you know, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s, where one studio... everybody has a contract to one sole studio, opposed to,
right.
You know,
right.
More of like the monopoly way of running a studio. I just kind of wonder if eventually we're going to start moving back into doing that.
Well, I would say you could argue that almost every industry is like that. The small mom and pop video store is going to do a better job at giving you movies to rent and customer service than Blockbuster, much like a small restaurant probably has better food than a chain restaurant and so forth. I think in most industries, tend to be the smaller independent ones care more and may need to charge more, but then you've got the bigger conglomerates that are more working for a profit than anything, including even in the arts, which is, you know, the big studios don't necessarily care what they put out movie-wise as long as it makes the money. Whereas, you know, you'll have a small independent person like making it for the love of art and filmmaking, and they're just telling a story and making a piece that if they make money, cool.
Indeed. And at the end of the day, just like the mom and pops, restaurants and video stores or what have you, they have to remain competitive. And if they can't, then they go out of business. So.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting. You'll definitely have to keep following this one, Tim. Let us know how it goes.
Will do. Now, what do you have, Matt?
I have two simple Star Wars bits of news. So right after Carrie Fisher confirmed that she was going to be in Star Wars last week,
uh-huh.
Episode 7, she had to take it back. So it turns out that she was joking, end quote. A rep for Carrie Fisher told CNN about her recent comment. Quote, nothing has been announced, end quote. So...
What a big just kidding, you know?
Yeah, well, and then I don't have the report on me, but 2 days later, another report came in and said everybody's hooked up. So, yeah,
right.
Here's the update. Now George Lucas confirms all three. So,
right.
We come back the next day. George Lucas is coming back, and he's saying that it is. So, I think we can safely say the Holy Trinity is coming back to do Episode 7.
To further that bit of news, though... Lucas, let me find the quote really quick, because he also then sort of took it back, which is to say, already signed Mark and Carrie and Harrison, or we were pretty much in the final stages of the negotiation. So I called and said, hey, look, this is what's going on. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that. I think they want to announce that with some big whoop-de-doo. But we were negotiating with him. I won't say whether the negotiations were successful or not, after his first sentence was, we had already signed them, before the actual sale happened. So it's pretty much, they're probably signed on. Whether they get used or not is different, but I think the cat's out of that bag.
Yeah, I think it's, exactly. I think that's pretty much, everybody's trying to hedge their bets just in case, you know, something catastrophic happens or whatever, but I think it's safe to say they're coming. And my final piece of news, also in regards to that, Joss Whedon.
Ah, that was my news story.
Oh, man, I wrote that down to bring that up next week. All right, I'm deleting that.
He was actually, he's doing a promo for Much Ado About Nothing. And he is asked what he, you know, we know you're a fan of Star Wars and that it would have been really nice if you could have done, if you could have been a director, blah, blah, blah. If you had been, you know, if you were directing, you know, how do you feel about basically the original characters coming back? He said, quote, you know, I wouldn't go back. I'd go forward. I would want to create characters that would resonate the way they did, end quote. So I think that's an interesting thing, but I think that as much as I like Joss Whedon and I'm a fan of a great deal of his work and he is a very good director, I think he has the wrong idea here, and in this instance I'm glad. I think that the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot approach is good, where you maybe not need every single character or everything, but if you have a convincing story that allows you to bridge what made the original great to what is going to be great going forward, then you're golden, because you get to have all the feel goodies about having the original guys come back, but then you can leave them and move on with your new stories and stuff. And, you know, just very well-placed cameos and well-written cameos are all it takes. So, mm-hmm. I have to disagree with Joss Whedon on this one.
Yeah, I think it just depends on if they're going to be cameos or if they're going to be, like, a significant part of the movie.
I would say it could also be both, where their characters are significant in the story, but we don't necessarily have them see a lot of screen time. But given, you know, the history of Star Wars, I would almost say the creation of new characters post the original trilogy, and even within the original trilogy, doesn't always go so well. You know, nobody wants Jar Jar. That was a new character. Yes, it was going back and not forward, but when you have characters that people already like and you can create a story, you know, I think it's safe to, yeah, try and bridge that into the future.
I think that, honestly, I have to, just because it's the most recent that I can think of, and it was just so incredibly well done for me as a fan. J.J. Abrams' Star Trek reboot was perfect. I think the way he used Spock, where Spock was basically a glorified cameo. I mean, he's on screen for all of, like, 3 minutes, and it's spread out over the course of the whole two-hour movie. So,
right.
That is exactly what I'm thinking. Now, it doesn't have to be the time travel thing again, but I'm just, that is a prime example of basically a glorified cameo, but it's well written and executed within the story that now allows us going forward, when we go here for Enter Darkness, you're not going to see Leonard Nimoy anymore.
Correct. Right.
So I think that, again, they'll be able to do that. So that's just where I land on it.
Yeah.
So, awesome. Okay, well, so then I'm sorry I stole your news, Andy.
Well, actually, it wasn't going to be about Star Wars. It was more of, in case this counts as news, I just thought it was interesting that we just got our first trailer for Much Ado About Nothing. And with that came news articles about the fact that Josh shot this in 12 days with his friends at his house in between picture wrapping and editing The Avengers. I just thought I like the way people like Soderbergh, or I guess now Whedon and other people, they do like a big studio movie and do all this time, and then they go do something for themselves and back and forth. And sometimes the smaller ones are good, sometimes they're not. But I just thought it was fun. He's like, I'm going to go hang out with my friends for 2 weeks and shoot a movie in my backyard.
Yeah, apparently it's gotten a pretty good reception so far from the people who've seen it. So and that's yeah. actually it's my all time favorite Shakespeare play. So I was in a version. I was in the play at one time. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Awesome. Nice. Well, cool. So let's go ahead and move on to a segment that we haven't done for quite some time, and that I'm afraid that if we go right into Three Squared, we won't get to, and we've been putting this off for apparently 3 or 4 weeks. So, do we really need that? There is a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, I understand?
Yes, well, it's not just Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The full title is Michael Bay's Teenage Mutant Ninja Way. Yes, way. To counteract that, no.
Holy crap. It's literally
serious?
Called Michael Bay's TMNT, seriously?
Well, it's gotta be. I mean, it's Michael Bay's Transformers. It's gotta be Michael Bay's Teenage
Mutant
Ninja.
No, but those are not the official titles. Yes, the official
title.
Oh,
it's not
the
it's not the official title, but I mean, it's not gonna be,
okay.
You know.
Well, I mean, The Avengers is technically called Marvel's The Avengers, but everyone just calls it The Avengers. I literally thought his name was in the title.
Yeah,
of the
way you said that, I thought it was going to be listed as Michael Bay's TMNT. I was like, what? No, come
no,
on, I'm
but,
with Andy there.
But he's directing it. So that's
right.
Just going to be... I shouldn't judge a movie before it's even made.
Hey,
but...
as long as they can put Vanilla Ice back in it.
And also they casted Megan Fox as April O'Neil, which
so did they make up then?
Well, see, that's what I was about to ask, you know, because like beforehand, after the second Transformers movie, she just completely bashed him, saying how non-professional she thinks he is, or something along the lines about how
well,
much
that and the fact that she thought that the movie was sucked, and
right,
guess what?
Yeah,
she
that
was
he
right.
doesn't. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, she was saying that he doesn't pay attention to acting. He only pays attention to special effects. And, so he wants her to be April O'Neil. And, that's...
As long as she dyes her hair, I'm potentially okay with it.
What color does she have?
Or,
is it
in lieu of her, perhaps we could get the April O'Neil, the porn actress. And have her just play April O'Neil.
Yeah.
Because she's hot, she does look like April O'Neil, because she does the cosplay for it when she's not doing porn, and then she does porn. So, I would go see this movie.
is April O'Neil's hair red?
Yeah.
It's kind
is
of an auburn.
Because I just remember her from, like, the cartoon. She always wore, like, yellow?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, yellow.
She sounds hot.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's hope she doesn't have like a buzz cut or anything.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say, I'm just going to answer your question, no.
Yeah.
No, we don't really need that. We don't need Michael Bay's TMNT. We don't need another Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I really don't think we need Megan Fox doing much of anything other than Playboy and porn.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, they need to do another cartoon like Mighty Max or something. I like Mighty Max. I think Mighty Max would be a great movie.
Honestly, I would think that it would just be better if they would do CGI for TMNT.
Well, they already did a CGI one.
From what I understand, that one was pretty good.
Well, okay. I
didn't see it. I don't. I have. To
I
say
have. I have seen it because I actually worked for the music supervisor on that movie, so I worked on that one for a while. It's not bad, but you just have to go into it as it's a kids' movie.
Yeah,
I'm sure kids
yeah.
liked it. But I'm never going to watch it again. I enjoyed working on it because it was just one of those, you know, like, oh my god, Ninja Turtles. But I wasn't excited about the film because I'm not the audience for it. And I don't think anyone that grew up watching the cartoon or the original movies is. I don't think they're the audience for this remake either. Some
but
remakes
is,
are
but
meant
I think,
to grab fanboys.
Yeah, but I think there comes a certain point, though. When you have to, as a fanboy, or just not even as a fanboy, but someone who grew up with the series, okay? I think there comes a point when you have to acknowledge the fact that there's not really a way to make it age appropriate going forward. It's got to remain for the initial target audience. How are they ever going to make something? How are you ever going to make a serious run? And I'm truly being serious here. how are you ever going to make a serious version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that people in their late 20s and early 30s are going to take seriously? There's no way to... You lose. There's just no way to do it. You have to market it towards kids who are into the latest revival of it,
yeah,
or the kids who were really young when the series was in its heyday in the 90s, because that would put them in their late teens, and then they'd still go... late teens, early 20s, and they'd probably still go have some beer and just go watch it for the sake of watching it.
Right, right.
So,
That's fair.
So, yeah.
But we certainly don't need it, regardless of any of that.
I highly agree.
Just like we totally need the Transformers 4.
Yeah.
I saw the first one, and that's where I stopped.
Yeah. Well,
the first one was good, the second one sucked ass, and the third one was better than the second one, not as good as the first, but redeemed it. Like, it was enough to, like, okay, at least they kind of salvaged it. So, and it's funny, because we're about to be talking about, well, pretty soon we're about to be talking about Top Ham or Top Cheese or Top Ham and Cheese, commonly referred to as Top Gun. And, you know... That this one gives us the 80s version of Michael Bay, which is Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson. So, yeah, that's going to be good. So, 3 Squared?
Yeah.
3 Squared. Okay, so movie scores. So, last week we did our favorite movie soundtracks. This time we're doing our favorite movie scores. And I'm going to go first because I'm pretty sure no one has come up with... I think this is one of those ones where I do not foresee any kind of crossover. Well, except for poor Mikey, who picked like the most obvious thing ever. But whatever, you know, we're gonna be nice to him about it. He's on vacation in Portland. All right, so the first one, I freely admit I'm double-dipping here, okay? Last week I said that The Crow... soundtrack was absolutely outstanding. Truly was. Has a couple of my favorite songs from various different bands and introduced me to some other bands. The score, equally amazing. So I'm going with The Crow as my first score. It was the first. This is the. These movies that I am telling you are the only movies where I have ever gone out of my way to actually get the score. Because that just never happens for me. So, The Crow is the first one. Excellent. It's also got some really interesting background music and stuff. Like, there's a scene where they're playing Eric's band, and they're playing an old record of his in the background and everything. That's not on the soundtrack. That's on the score. So right. you actually get to hear some really interesting mood music and interesting ways that they tied in stuff that technically has lyrics but was not considered part of the soundtrack. And on, of course, also the music's just amazing as well. Next for me is Crimson Tide. And this is the 1995 submarine film directed by Tony Scott, also produced by Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer. I wonder what else they may have done.
Nothing
together
else, surely.
That involved the Navy. I don't know. Top Gun. So, this one
Cock
is basically... Yeah, that too. So basically this is a movie where Denzel Washington is playing... the first officer to Gene Hackman. They are on a sub, and they're basically on the brink of nuclear war, and they have to make a decision, and they disagree on the decision, and chaos ensues. And you just can't have that on a nuclear sub. But you do. So, it's really one of those things where do you follow the letter of the law, or do you follow the spirit of the law? And it's just absolutely... I thought it was a really great movie. And I got that score. So I was really all about it. It was outstanding. Final for me is the 1993 version of The Three Musketeers. Okay. Of course, this is the one that has Charlie Sheen, Kiefer Sutherland, Chris O'Donnell.
All
introduced
for one.
Me to In Oliver Platt. Love. I had never really known who Oliver Platt was before this. Tim Curry, and of course Rebecca De Mornay. Yes, that one terrible 90s ballad is the first lead-off track for the album.
What was However, it, Bryan Adams and Sting?
It's Bryan Adams, Sting, and Rod Stewart.
Gotcha.
Trifecta.
Yes, of British pop, rock, soul crap from the 90s.
Bryan Adams isn't British.
Oh, that's right. Canadian. Sorry.
Hey.
Canadian and then British.
Bryan Adams also was a part of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, let's not forget.
Yeah, I guess you just couldn't get enough of that period crap. So, at any rate, so we all know the story of Three Musketeers and how basically by the end of the day, it's the Four Musketeers. However, the score is really fantastic. The music is definitely amazing, great upbeat pieces to it, great movements as well. And it was just very well put together. And I, you know, was just absolutely blown away that the music was this good coming out of a Disney picture. So those are my movies. 1994's The Crow, 1995's Crimson Tide, and 1993, The Three Musketeers.
Nice. All right, my three. I'll start it off with 1958's Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo with... Awesome music by Bernard Herrmann. It's very suspenseful. I mean, if you just watch the opening theme of the movie or the opening credits and whatnot, you can just get a really good taste of the flavor of the music throughout the entire movie. Just super entertaining, and it keeps you up and upbeat and moving around also. My next favorite is from Snow White and Seven Dwarfs, 1937, Walt Disney's first feature film. And believe it or not, this... movie Snow White was the very first film to have its own soundtrack, to buy it on record back in the day. So that's really exciting. It's very, I mean, I'm sure by now most of you have at least watched the movie or even has heard of the movie or just seen or watched bits and pieces of it. The movie is very whimsical. It's the stereotypical Disney classic Disney soundtrack where everything is happy. Great melodies in it, and it's just very, very, very pretty music. My last movie, and it's also one of my favorite movies, but it's my favorite movie score. It's also supposed to be David Lynch's favorite movie score as well. It's Roman Polanski's Chinatown from 1974. Originally, Philip Landbrough was originally hired to do the scoring of the movie, but at the last minute, the score was rejected by producer Robert Evans, so they brought in Jerry Goldsmith, and he only had 10 days to record the score for the entire movie. And what the movie is really known for is the trumpet solos throughout. And the trumpet solos are have been said to be compared to like to be very haunting, to really delve into the psyche of the main character, Giddy's, which is Jack Nicholson's character. So you have the haunting music. It fits the time period. It's the classic noir movie. So my three again: Vertigo, Snow White, and Chinatown.
Okay. I also picked a Bernard Herrmann score, which I think is better. Also, Hitchcock, North by Northwest, 1959. Certainly that opening theme during the credits always gets in my head. Vertigo is also very good, but I think North by Northwest is gotta be my favorite of Herrmann's scores. My second one is famous Italian composer Nino Rota's For the Godfather, 1972. I had the pleasure of projecting that for a class a couple weeks ago, and Godfather Part 2, and I do it every semester, and those are two of the few movies that I'm always watching when I'm projecting, and I'm always humming the score for days afterwards, not even bothered by it. And my third is 1990's Home Alone by John Williams. I will forever love that score. It's not serious, it's not, you know, important at all, but even outside of Christmas time, I get some of those songs stuck in my head. I don't know where they come from. Like, you know, I'm sure I could have gone Jurassic Park for John Williams. Clearly, we're not going to go E.T. and Star Wars. Home Alone, one of the unsung John Williams scores.
Do you ever drive down Santa Monica with the soundtrack of Home Alone blaring with your windows down?
No. But mostly because I rarely drive down Santa Monica.
Oh.
Well, all right then.
Awkward.
That is a very good soundtrack, though, Home Alone. Definitely.
Yeah, it really is.
Awesome. Okay, well then, I think we've got it for everybody. Next week's Three Squared, since we're discussing Oz the Great and Powerful, which is technically a prequel to The Wizard of Oz, we're going to discuss our favorite prequels. So, that'll be cool. So, mm-hmm. If you guys know of any, then, you know, hey, submit them, let them know, let us know, whatever. Alright, so, on to the movies. What movie do we want to do first?
Let's do Top Gun.
Alright, Top Ham and Cheese it is. Alright, now, I freely admit that, you know, I was 9 years old when this movie came out, and I was thoroughly fascinated by all the air, the amazing cinematography when it comes to the dogfighting, which, to this day, is some of the best aerial footage I've ever seen. That aspect of this movie has not changed. Unfortunately, the rest of the movie didn't age well at all. This is a quintessential 80s action movie, though. This was what big budget, massive, successful movies were made of. Again, why I chose this as a soundtrack-driven movie, because the soundtrack was unreal. Given the fact that this movie was made on a $15 million budget, in 1986, okay, and raked in, remember, 1986, $356 million. I think we can say that even though the critics didn't like it, the people kind of said, screw you, critics. The critics really were not all that pleased with this movie. However, Take My Breath Away won Academy Award for Best Song.
Yeah. Well, it was Georgia Marauder, so...
I know, I'm just saying, that's kind of crazy how that stuff works out. I think that, for me, even the nostalgia factor was not enough to save this movie for me. I have left it with its initial rating of 4 stars in my Netflix queue, because that's what I gave it way back when I joined Netflix and was like, oh, I've seen this movie. So I didn't change it, but it really... That's a nostalgia rating for me. I think that, I'm quoting Wikipedia here, but Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times gave the film 2.5 out of 4 stars, pointing out that, quote, movies like Top Gun are hard to review because the good parts are so good and the bad parts are so relentless, end quote. And that's pretty much what I have to say about this movie.
I'd also like to let everyone know that it won Best Foreign Language Film in Japan.
No, that's crap, hilarious. It did. Oh yeah, yep. Wow.
That is just ridiculous. I can't, you know, wow.
So a bunch of people in Japan in the 80s said, "That's the best movie that's not in Japanese."
Top Gun.
Do wow. with that what you will.
Oh, Lee, you got to see Top Gun. It's so good.
Don't do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I gotta say that the movie does... it accomplishes the illusion that the actors are actually flying so well that kind of carries the movie for me very much. And especially, it also has Mr. Strickland in there, and as well as Michael Ironside. I dug that. Like, the two biggest a-holes in some of film history are in this movie. And I also like that the black guy, the only black guy in the movie, is just randomly there. Like, if you'd watch any scene when it's all the Top Gun guys together, like, there's always...
Hey, now.
The black guy is just right there.
Hey, now, he had to do something, okay?
He's usually just, like,
so that
laughing.
He could get him... So, no, he had to do that role so that he could get onto Matlock, all right?
Well, it was the 80s.
He had to do that role. Now, did anybody notice the young Tim Robbins coming out of nowhere?
I know, yeah.
And then, of course, I knew about Meg Ryan. I had totally forgotten that Tim Robbins was in this movie.
When did he? When did Bill Durham come out? It must not have been that. It was Bill Durham 80.
It was like, yeah, it was. It was like right after that.
We're all googling really quick. 88.
Yeah.
Okay.
2 years later.
And wasn't Bill Durham the movie that launched Tim Robinson's
pretty
career?
Much. Yes.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Tim Robbins. And
so, okay, so.
And what's
I'm
with
sorry, go ahead,
in the volleyball scene? That is the most okay. awkward scene in any 80s movie. Like, you have guys
actually, no,
playing
this
volleyball
was why,
with jean pants.
This was
with no shirt
genius. Part. This was genius on Tony Scott's part, you see, because he knew that dudes were going to be dragging their women to this movie kicking and screaming, right? And that Tom Cruise was just kind of developing as a sex symbol at this point. So that scene was solely eye candy for the chicks.
But
and
now
it worked.
Now
it worked.
When chicks watch, when girls watch it, when women watch it, I would think a number of them will think that it is super awkward because they're now you look at it and like every time somebody makes a good shot, they walk away from the camera holding each other.
Mm. Well,
and you don't see
I don't
that
know.
A lot now.
Maybe,
I mean,
maybe
it's very
it was
prolonged.
Just their way of introducing some, you know, some sexual tension between the guys.
Maybe it was. Just the jeans and the no shirt just really gets me.
Yeah, poor Anthony Edwards. He was clearly the only one that wasn't cut because he's the one wearing the terrible t-shirt
now,
during that scene.
Now, before Tony Scott passed away, died, what... There have been some talk that they were wanting to do a sequel, but I guess that kind of went away before he killed himself. I just wonder what the sequel would have been like. I mean, it would have been nothing like the original Top Gun.
Sure, why not? All they have to do is basically remake Top Gun virtually the same way, and then replace Tom Skerritt and Michael Ironside with Val Kilmer and Tom Cruise.
I think you would also replace fighter jets with drones nowadays, right?
I guess. That'd be kind of
maybe.
Cool,
I mean, there's still something to be said for people needing to dogfight just because you're not doing it as often.
Yeah. I was always partial growing up to a not as good movie, but preceded it by a few months. Iron Eagle. I always preferred Iron Eagle growing up. We had
I liked those movies. I liked Iron Eagle, Iron Eagle 2, and Iron Eagle 3, baby.
Yeah. You know, it costs more money. Costs more money to make. Doesn't have as beautiful of the cinematography and editing and music. Made no money. But it had a bunch of sequels.
That was when they discovered the direct-to-video aspect.
You know what another good fighter jet movie is? Clint Eastwood's Firefox from the early 80s.
That is a very good movie, yeah. Technologically. I found, though, going back and watching it, it's pretty slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The concept
I tried watching
super
it again.
Cool for the
time. Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I was totally in with that. It was kind of like the same thing with Daryl, you know, with the whole it was all connected by flight, you know, by thought and all that kind of stuff. And it was pretty badass.
Yeah. Now I'll fully admit I did not rewatch Top Gun before talking about this because I've just seen it enough times, but I don't understand why so many people, even if you love the movie, were so excited about IMAX 3D re-release. Because, like, I understand it might seem like it would be cool for the dog fighting part, and maybe that is true, but it wasn't shot in 3D, and most conversions don't work so well, and I feel like I would be overwhelmed by IMAX 3D air spinning around.
I gotta say, I agreed with you. Until yesterday.
Okay.
All right, because turns out that right before they do these re-releases, because Jurassic Park is being re-released IMAX 3D.
Right, which I also don't understand, but maybe
okay.
You'll change my mind.
And so about a month before the release of Top Gun in select IMAX theaters, maybe all of them, but definitely select IMAX, they were showing a four-minute scene from the movie.
Oh.
So you actually got to see it redone. I was like, I'm not sure if I want to see Jurassic Park again, because that was a movie I saw 10 times in the theater, okay? I was, seriously, I was a Jurassic Park freak.
Oh yeah, I saw it at least twice in the theater.
So they showed Jurassic Park last night. Okay, the scene where the T-Rex, where you first get to see the T-Rex. Okay.
Okay.
They nailed it. It was amazing. I literally, you would have thought the thing was shot in 3D.
Okay.
So,
because I was, you know, my line when I've had friends that usually don't seem to like 3D, but have been really excited about both Top Gun and Jurassic Park, inviting me on Facebook to go see it with them. And I'm thinking, my favorite movie of all time, if I had to pick one, is Ghostbusters. If they put Ghostbusters in 3D, I really don't think I would go see it, because I pretty much don't like 3D 90% of the time. And I don't think I've ever actually paid for it. I've only ever seen 3D movies when I'm seeing them for free, which, even when seeing them for free, I tend to not really enjoy it. But maybe if you say they nailed it for Jurassic Park, I'll think about that. I would see that.
I was thoroughly impressed. That sealed it for me. I'm definitely gonna see it now. So.
Even with the scene being like really dark, I mean, did they like lighten up the color any?
If they did, I couldn't tell because they used enough neutral tone. If they did, they used enough neutral tones with the ambient light that it looked natural. So, I could not tell you that for sure. All I know is just it looked fantastic. So, at any rate. So, Rape of Europa then?
Yeah.
Okay, Rape of Europa. Interesting movie, too long, and about stuff that I'd already known about as a history major, you know. yeah. It's basically, this movie is essentially about the Nazis and how they plundered all the art, or as much art as possible in Europe. And what they did with it to hide it and confiscate it and stuff like that. In addition, it also showed how the importance of art did actually eventually play a role in how the war was fought overall. Because, you know, you want to win and you need to destroy the enemy, but you don't want to destroy the culture at the same time. So... I definitely thought it was good. I just, for me, it was just too long.
I absolutely love this movie. I mean, I was a history minor, and every time we had to study World War II, they talked about it, about Hitler and his art fetish, and just this whole process of him trying to take art and, you know, build his own. He wanted to make his own museum, his art museum, but they only kind of brushed the subject, not really going into detail. And where some people will say this movie is really long, but it's super informative. And it also talks about, as well as art, architecture as well. The process of Hitler wanting to damage buildings, very historical, old buildings. And also from the American side, the Allies destroying some of these old buildings as well. And having to, which they talk about close to the end of the movie, where they make a map of the specific movies to not bomb, or not specific city, excuse me, the specific buildings to not bomb so they don't ruin any of this precious architecture. So where the movie is long, which, I mean, it is very long, and it is, there are a lot of subtitles, so if there are people out there that do not like subtitles, or do not even like history, then this is definitely... Not your kind of movie. But if you don't know anything about it, I highly recommend it. Even if it does take you, I don't know, two watchings or 2 days to watch the whole movie, it's totally.
Yeah, good. Again, I'm like you. I'm you know, you were a history minor. I'm a history major, and so you know, I've been inundated with World War II stuff for quite some time. I've always been very fascinated by it. So for me, I think one of the reasons why it was so long was because there was so much in here I already knew.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was just kind of like, okay, I know this part. And then it would do something where they would talk about something I didn't know about. And I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of cool. And then they would do something that, yeah, so.
Yeah, I would say my main thoughts were just that context is king, certainly for stuff like this. When I first started watching it, I thought to myself, why am I watching something I would see in a history class or an art history class for a film podcast? I was honestly very confused why this was what we were watching. And then upon my second viewing, I felt a little bit more interested, and I just sort of didn't worry about why I was watching it. And it's fine. It was just a little dry. I don't even think it's too long. It's under 2 hours by a smidge. It just feels long because it's more of just a catalog of places that they went and things that they took. And I didn't know about the specifics, but I had known that this had happened. But I never really felt connected to anything, and I just sort of felt like we were following a timeline and following a map marching through Europe without them ever actually giving us a visual map or timeline. I prefer my documentaries to sort of engage and intrigue and use things, and it was literally just cutting between some old footage talking about art, which was fine, but what I really liked is the segment about the Monuments Men, the U.S. Army art experts that were working on the front lines to help deal with that. I wouldn't mind seeing a film more just specifically about them. So yeah, I mean, my thing was just, it's not a bad movie, but it's not really what I expected to watch unless I was being taught about this stuff.
Yeah, no, I will say that I think that it would be really neat. I think I will try myself to follow up on the in Pisa, the Constapio, whatever it was, the place where all the frescoes accidentally got burned.
Yeah, right. And frescoes sounds good.
I would like to follow up on that at some point and see if they are ever able to get that back to some semblance of what it was before.
Yeah,
I found myself burned.
Caring more about, there's a segment early on of when, you know, somebody realized that they had something and returned it. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I cared about that moment, and then it just sort of went back to, and then they kept doing this. And I never really felt engaged with the film. I just felt like I should be taking notes for a test later.
Yeah, and to answer your question about why we would be watching this for a film podcast, it's just a reason for me to piss people off.
I don't think you're pissing people
no,
off.
I know. I'm kidding. No, I just like this stuff. So I just sometimes tend to.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like when I came up with Joe Dreams of Sushi, you know.
But that movie, they're very different. I feel like.
True, but that's the point. That's why I think that was one of the reasons why we decided that when we wanted to do this podcast, that's how we came up with it, because this was, you know, something where we could bring in, it's not just going to be about what's new at the box office. It's not just going to be about action movies or dramas. I mean, it's going to be about all kinds of film. And yeah, the only way to expose people to all kinds of film is to cover all kinds of film.
Yeah, that's fair. I just feel like Jiro Dreams of Sushi also isn't a flashy documentary with animation and all this kind of stuff. It just has beautiful photography of sushi. And
yes, it is food
this
porn.
This really intriguing story of this old man and a tiny little thing. Like, I don't love sushi. I will eat it sometimes.
but to be fair to Rape of Europa, though, you have to be fair to Rape of Europa. There's only so much you can do with stock footage from World War II.
Well, I know. I think maybe it's just World War II. It's so commonplace a topic, even to this day. Yeah, I don't know. There's so many documentaries. I watch them all the time. I guess I don't personally tend towards those types, which is not saying that they're bad. Just for me personally, those aren't the ones I tend to watch. But it was, you know, it's not a bad movie. I felt like it could have been punched up a little bit to make it a little more engaging.
A little more saucy.
All right, well, let's move on to our last movie then, Oz the Great and Powerful. And I gotta say, this is the second best movie I've seen all year. I absolutely loved this movie. And I am, of course, bearing in mind that this movie is PG. Mm-hmm. So you can't expect it to be the same seriousness and the same, I don't know. You can't expect the same level of complexity and seriousness in the storyline and the plot as you can in like a PG-13 or an R movie. Mm-hmm. So I think that they did it where there were some parts that were pretty simple, but nothing that was insultingly so. the special effects were just absolutely outstanding.
Oh yeah, no shit.
Hands down, start to finish was just amazing. Cinematography is beautiful. The 3D, I'm like you, Andy. I'm not a huge fan of 3D. I too got to see this for free, so you know. I mean to tell you, I was completely blown away. I thought this was great. The only thing that I did not particularly enjoy, and you know what? Fuck Warner Brothers, because it's their fault. is I was not particularly fond of Mila Kunis's makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is because Warner Brothers wouldn't let Disney have any reference to Wizard of Oz. So they couldn't use, for instance, like if you noticed the Yellow Brick Road when they were visiting Glinda or... Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they were visiting Glinda's castle and stuff. In Wizard of Oz, it was a complete spiral, mm-hmm. right? In Oz the Great and Powerful, it's a circle in the middle of another circle that then, about, you know, 3 or 4 feet away, the spirals start going outward from there.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't have a spiraled circle going all the way to the end. They couldn't make any mention of the ruby slippers, which I think is going to be fine because at the end of the day, Disney can just come in and say, well, who cares about ruby slippers? They were silver slippers in the book, so we'll just use silver slippers and F you. but when it came down, like, they wouldn't let them use the mole that What's-Her-Face with the Wicked Witch of the West wore. You know, so they had to do the makeup enough. So even down to the color had to be legally different.
Yep, it was a different shade of green.
And so...
Yeah, it wasn't quite as poopy green as the original.
Yeah.
Right. So, they, you know, so given those changes, I mean, they clearly did the best that they could with it. But I was just a little disappointed. I wasn't really jazzed about that. Everything else, though, absolutely fantastic. I liked the way it carried out. I liked to watch the struggle of James Franco as he really does try to overcome the fact that he really is just a con man.
Mm-hmm.
I love Michelle Williams, who became exceedingly hot for me.
Yeah.
Rachel Weisz, I think, was actually the hottest of all three of them. But, you know, that's just my personal opinion. And I liked how they kind of did the juxtaposition for this movie and Wizard of Oz, where a couple of key characters in the black and white area come up in the color section.
Yep.
And I really just, I mean, it was kind of like you were truly experiencing Oz. It was literally like if you were taking yourself as a kid and experiencing Oz for the first time, and you got to do it all over again, only with the graphics that they are today. Yeah. And I was totally blown away. So
I was equally, pretty much everything said, I totally agree with. I don't like 3D. I have, the highest compliment I've ever come to was, it didn't bug me. Except for this movie, and I guess Avatar, I've only seen it in 3D, and I wouldn't think it would be interesting to watch not in 3D, because to me it was just an exercise in 3D, but this movie was beautiful, and I've seen clips of it on TV shows. I realize it's TV, but I'm like, that looks weird and not as good as if you were seeing it in 3D.
Yeah.
There's just enough of the, like, hey, we're throwing something at your face to satisfy the people that like that tends to bug me, but it wasn't the entire movie. It was just like, hey, in case you didn't know, this is 3D. It was just whatever they did, they used their planes very well. Some of the movies that they've converted into 3D after shooting are the ones that look like just flat cardboard things behind each other. This one was shot in 3D, and they did a wonderful job making that work, along with all the rest of the effects.
Yes.
And I thought I was going to hate Zach Braff as a monkey, but he was delightful.
Yeah, he was my favorite character of the entire
really
movie.
Was maybe, yeah. Yeah, he was maybe my favorite character.
He was like, really good. I also did spend every waking moment of that movie keeping my eyes peeled for Bruce Campbell. So I was very excited when I found him.
Oh, I didn't realize that he was in there somewhere.
He's in every Sam Raimi movie because of the Evil Dead connection.
True. That is true.
Yeah,
he was the guard that got hit by the...
Yeah, he's the guard that Nook keeps hitting on the head when they keep trying to get back inside.
Well, damn it, now I have to go see it again, which is fine, because I actually, I went into it with no expectations, meaning I didn't expect it to be bad, I didn't expect it to be good, I was like, it's going to be what it's going to be, and I'm going to watch this movie. And to my surprise, it was, like I said, literally delightful is what I've been telling everyone. I'm like, it was delightful. A couple weeks ago, you know, I had seen Jack the Giant Slayer, and that is one of those movies that I don't understand the audience that it's being made for, because it's too scary for most kids, but too kiddy for more adults, and I just sort of like, eh, it wasn't a terrible movie, but I'm not like happy I saw it, I'll never watch it again. Whereas Oz, I think, did in a way that Disney succeeds, as Pixar did before they bought them and since, to make a movie that everyone can enjoy, and they're not seeing a kid's movie and finding the good things, and they're not seeing an adult movie and things are going over the head. Like, it's just delightful. I don't know.
Exactly. And I have to say, I am very excited to take my almost 6-year-old daughter back so that we can see this movie, because, I mean, it really is good for kids too. There's a couple of there's a couple of intense scenes, I think, for little kids, but they're not as they're probably nothing. I said that if you saw Brave, I compared it to when the bear attacks in Brave. It's about as scary as that. So if your kid can manage that, then your kid can handle Oz Great and Powerful. All right, so I guess, you know, sounds like Andy and I love this movie. What did you think, Tim?
All right, so I think Oz the Great and Powerful accomplished what Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland failed at doing, and that is producing a prequel that is both visually entertaining and it has an original, a really good storyline to go along with it that encompasses everything that we loved about The Wizard of Oz without taking a massive shit all over it.
Yes.
And now, a lot of people love the show Wicked. I hated Wicked. I went and saw it on Broadway and I fell asleep. Now, everything that I did not like about Wicked, like the origin story, they succeeded in doing with Oz and the Great and Powerful. That's pretty much not making the Wicked whatsoever. Completely different storyline, and it's brilliant. I mean, this is the best 3D I have seen after Hugo and Avatar, and this is where 3D enhances the movie experience to where it takes you more into the movie instead of it being just a, like, a sideshow spectacle, like Jack the Giant Slayer, of what I am guessing was, in a way. The special effects in this movie are night and day better than Jack the Giant Slayer. You're actually brought into this world of Oz. Beautiful art direction. I mean, the people that made this movie, you can just tell that they took their time in creating this fantastic, beautiful atmosphere. And just the storyline and the storytelling is just brilliant, and it definitely has that Sam Raimi touch to it that we all of us fans know and love. However, the one problem I have is that I thought it was kind of miscast in certain roles. Like, I didn't really care for James Franco all that much. Like, I just didn't buy him trying to be charming. I didn't buy him as a sly, witty, mischievous kind of guy. It just seemed like there were times where he was just trying too hard. I'm going to be seeing this movie again with my girlfriend this weekend, so I'm hoping that now I know what to expect, I'll be able to enjoy this movie even more, much more than how I already did enjoy it. However, it's got to say something where this movie that is definitely a story and effects driven, just pretty much that alone just carries this movie entirely, in my opinion, because it's just that good. So I highly recommend people seeing it, and it's kind of dark also, which is kind of cool too.
Indeed, indeed.
Quick question: what are your thoughts on James Franco pre this movie? Just in general, like short version of that question.
My favorite character of his that I mean the only character of his that I really liked was his performance in Pineapple Express, if that says anything. I just don't. I mean, I haven't seen Howl, and there's another movie that
neither have I. I heard it was terrible.
Yeah, and I just like I guess I don't really care for him as a person, and that kind of affects it in a way, I think. And I know a lot of people love him. I think a lot of people like him because of his looks and just how he is.
I think a lot of people hate him too. That's why I asked, because did you buy him in Kansas?
No. Well, I mean, what's crazy is that there are aspects of it where he fit fine, he fit well. It's just when it came to the love story, I just didn't buy the love story. Because, like, the love story that happens him with Glinda at the end reminded me of the love story he had with Thedora and with the Carney chick at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. So it just, I mean, it's just his character to me didn't fit. Also, the elf, the Nook elf. I thought that character was miscast. I thought
Are you calling? Are you calling him an elf?
Elf. I'm sorry, Munchkin. That's what I meant. Well, because he played an elf in Bad Santa.
I know.
So that's what I think.
Why, that's why I asked if you were going with Bad Santa, because.
Yeah, no, I meant
it's the great Tony Cox.
Yeah, no, I meant Munchkin. It's just, you know, it just seemed like it. There are aspects where they sacrificed having a name and having familiarity with having an actual they're playing characters, but a character that really differentiates themselves from all the ever characters in such a way that makes it a fantasy. Type of movie. Cause, I mean, like, for that character, for example, it just seemed like they were just going for the stereotypical, you know, smart-talking black guy, to be honest. But then again, that's just my kind of, in some odd way, nitpicky, cynical way of looking at things. But, I mean, even with all that stuff, the movie is just so entertaining. Even with being... just shy, you know. Actually, it was a 2-hour movie. It's just very entertaining, and it's one of those where if it was, you know, 2.5 hours long, if it was just as good, I would have thoroughly enjoyed it. Especially the ending was really good. I really liked how, you know, the whole climax of the movie was just well put together.
Yeah.
So, awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, well, good. I'm glad we all agreed on it.
Yeah, it's been a while since that's happened. So. Awesome. Okay. Well, Andy's a good luck charm. Okay.
Woo.
So, yeah. Okay. Well, then next week we're going to be doing The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, The Man Who Loved Women, and The Frighteners. So, that'll be fun. Those last two are available on Netflix Instant Streaming for those who don't have a lot of money or just don't want to go to the movies for whatever reason. And I guess that brings us to the spiel. So, the music you've been listening to has been provided to us graciously by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can find them at ReverbNation.com. Go to Houston, search Cries of Solace. You can also go to Facebook or MySpace.com, both slash Cries of Solace. You can even check out their website, CriesofSolace.com. As far as we're concerned, we're still the SLS Cast, and you can send us emails to theslscast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast. You can also go and look us up on Facebook. Just search the SLS Cast, and you can go to our website, slscast.com. And also, we are available to subscribe on iTunes. So, until next week, adieu.
Cheers, guys.
Goodbye. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.